You're listening to the Thoroughbred Post on the Equisport Radio Network. Brought to you by Ballyrose, your full-service South Florida farm and bloodstock agency. And now from Ballyrose Farm, here is our host Les Saltzman.
That's our Prix de l'Arc de Triomphe. It's a wide-open race. They bet about 3.5, 7 to 2 the field here. Alpinista is just the market leader. This is Mari Astralis. One from the outside he's drawn, stall number 19. Stay Foolish is the only one wider than him. Broom then is still to go forward. Been a solid campaigner over the years. Stall number 14, Mendocino. René Pichaluk, who won the race 12 months ago on Torquay de Tasso, is now Mendocino. That's it. They're all in. They're set to go. And away, racing in the arc, they get away in a fairly decent line. 2,400 metres is the trip. Stay Foolish was out quickly, but title holder's going to be the leader. And Mousseau to have the advantage. To running in second position is Broom, Al Hakim, Alpinista and Deep Bond and Westover and Stay Foolish are behind these. Then comes Mendocino, Alan Kerr and Mari Astralis and Seeleway and Mostard Af, Luxembourg against the running rail. Deduce is further back in the field with Ernesto, then Bubble Gift. Mishriff is the back marker, and just preceding that is Grand Glory as they begin to settle down. And it's title holder who leads them behind the wood, showing in front to Broom in the check jacket, grey and white in second position. Silver colours of Al Hakim and Deep Bond in the blue and red. Alpinista, grey mare, she holds about fifth position. Westover, a pink jacket in company with her, some yellow jacket there of Stay Foolish. Races up round the outside of Mendocino. Behind these then is Mari Astralis and Luxembourg. Further back to Alan Kerr and Seeleway. Torquay de Tasso missed him out first way round. He's about five from the right of your picture. Trapped out wide. Grand Glory is still the back marker. Mishriff is towards the rear also with Deduce as they begin their way on towards home. They're very well strung out. He set a really good pace, this title holder. Broom is about a half length behind him in second. Al Hakim is three lengths off these in third. To Alpinista against the running rail, Deep Bond is next. Westover, Mendocino, Stay Foolish behind these from Verdeni and Mari Astralis. Seeleway and Torquay de Tasso and Luxembourg as they enter the full straight. Alan Kerr behind these. Ernesto's trapped away against the running rail. Torquay de Tasso is the, well, they were yellow towards the outside there. He's making good headway though. But this title holder is leading them okay at the moment as they enter the home straight in the arc. Broom is in second place. Alpinista's moved into third. Al Kahim behind these in fourth. Westover heads the remainder. Behind him, Torquay de Tasso. Then comes Grand Glory towards the outside with Mostard off. Alpinista in second at the moment. The pace setter title holder beginning to struggle. Alpinista, Vaden is coming there very strongly as well. Al Kahim is with those. That is Broom there also. As Alpinista now and Luke Morris have taken it up. Al Hakim is in chase. Here's Torquay de Tasso in the yellow jacket. Vaden is still there. They're inside the last 200 metres. Alpinista in front. Verdeni, the green colours. Torquay de Tasso, the yellow. They're closing on her, but she's gutsy. She's brave. She's done it. Alpinista's won it. To Verdeni, Torquay de Tasso behind these. Al Hakim, Grand Glory was next to Luxembourg, and then came Westover and Alan Coronesto. Broom behind this, then title holder Stay Foolish. Mendocino, Mishriff. Further back to Mari Astralis. Oh, they're still coming. Seeleway and Bobble Gift. Then Mostard Daff, and I think Deep Bond is the final one.
Welcome to the show. And folks, the race that you've just heard is a race that was breathtaking just a couple of weeks ago. Sir Mark Prescott joins us, the man who trained and orchestrated a brilliant campaign for that mare. Sir Mark, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me, Les. Very kind of you.
When we first reached out, it was before the arc. And the reason I wanted to get you on the show is I've followed your career since probably 35, 40 years ago. And that of Heath House. And I wanted to get our audience the opportunity to hear some of your opinions and your points of view, because I think here in the United States, we call people that have been around for a long period of time and have made tremendous impact pillars of the industry. And I believe you're certainly a pillar of the international industry with your outlook in the things that you've done as a director in Newmarket?
Well, I hope I have. I mean, Newmarket's been my great love, really, because we have 2,500 acres of gallops here and 2,500 horses. And I ran the gallops for 46 years together with the Jockey Club agent. And when I started 50 years ago training, there were 750 horses here and 35 trainers. And now there's 2,500 horses and 81 trainers. So to deal with that increase in numbers was a great triumph, really, and has resulted in Newmarket being the largest training centre in the world by some margin.
The modernization of, obviously, of using the all-weather, that of course facilitates the larger numbers. But one of the things that I've noticed is you've been able to maintain the heritage of the sport. And as somebody in my latter years, that heritage is so important for us to pass on. And Heath House, in particular, is kind of a museum, and you've enhanced it rather than just let it go by.
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, I suppose all of us, or many of us, become slaves to our property, don't we? And you invest, God knows, in your property, which will never be repaid in its value, but you do it for somebody else, don't you, who comes along later.
Yes, and also, I think there's a certain pleasure when you walk in the yard first thing in the morning and you see the heads pop out of the stalls, and then they go on to train, and they get to relax and have a pick of grass in a place that you've designed or redesigned or formulated.
Yeah, I think it was a great pleasure in that. And I think all horsemen, I mean, you're a horseman, you've done everything. I think all of us, when you have a great day, like Alpinista winning the Arc, or which was up my great day, I think there's a tremendous satisfaction, not in the applause of the crowd on the day, perhaps that's wonderful and often overwhelming, but I think all of us have that bit of smug, shall I say, self-satisfaction when you look at the animal a couple of days later and it's nice and relaxed and sound and picking grass in the paddock or in the woods at the top of Warren Hill. You'd be a cold soul if you didn't feel a sense of pride, yeah.
And in your case, as with Alpinista, you've had decades of the family or generations of the family, and you've seen them develop.
That's my great privilege, because Miss Rousing, who bred them at Landwaite Stud, she has been an owner here for 36 years, I think it is. And so Alpinista, I trained her mother and her grandmother and most of her siblings. So it was an extraordinary moment, I think, for both Miss Rousing and myself, when you finally produce the highest rated filly, I think, certainly in Europe or in the world. It was a marvellous moment for her and marvellous moment for me. But as every trainer will tell you, getting the raw material is the most important thing.
And the breeding of the mare is so interesting. You know, with the Northern Dancer influence on both top and bottom, and then with the Sir Ivor on the dam side as well, it's just a very fascinating pedigree to look at, combining a Aga Khan family with a Navarre pedigree. It's brilliant, actually, when you really look at it.
Well, that's all down to Miss Rousing. She bought Al Rukaba, she bought the foundation mare. I think for 12,000, she'd won at Brighton and strained a tendon. And the Aga Khan had this marvellous Mumtaz Mahal family. and he'd nurtured it and done wonderfully well for him, but it sort of went dormant, and suddenly out of nowhere it took off, and it was my great luck to have bought a filly called Last Second, who was jointly bred by Miss Rousing and Mrs. Rogers at Airlie Stud. And with Paul Webber, I bought Last Second, and she became champion three-year-old filly of Britain. And because I had her, I then got sent other branches of the family by principally Miss Rousing, but also Mrs. Rogers. And from it, I think I'm right in saying something like 16 Group 1 winners I've trained, thanks to that bit of luck of buying Last Second. And as we all know, everybody in your career, you need that slice of luck, and that was my lucky day.
We do need the luck, but in getting to know your story, preparation is as much a part of it as luck. And maybe you can tell us about your first day with Mr. Waugh at Heath's stable.
Yes, I'd had a very unsuccessful riding career and broke my back and been in hospital for 18 months. And eventually I got out and I went home. And again, luck played its part because I had a very good stepfather. And he had been at Cambridge, which is near Newmarket in England. And he'd had an affair with a very pretty Newmarket girl. And some 40 years later, she came down to stay with her new boyfriend, who was a very famous retired jockey called Jack Leach. And anyway, so this safe home for the weekend it was for them. And when Jack Leach went back to Newmarket, he met Mr. Waugh on the Heath. And Mr. Waugh said, I'm getting on, I need someone to help me. And Jack Leach said, I know just the man. So he rang me and told me to go and meet Mr. Waugh the next day at Newbury. And I lived in Devon, which was 6 hours' drive away in those days. So I went up and met Mr. Waugh at Newbury after his horse ran rather poorly. And I tentatively introduced myself. And he said, well, he said, we'll give you a month's trial. I'll see you tomorrow. Come to the house at 11 o'clock. So I had to drive back to Devon, pack everything up I owned, and then drive back to Newmarket. So I was driving for over 13 hours. And I arrived on time for my meeting with him. And I never saw home again. So what a remarkable thing that was. And but he was a very tough man. And he showed me around evening stables, which is a great tradition in Newmarket and hardly done nowadays, but whereby the trainer goes round and looks at every horse and feels their legs, and the stable lads and girls have to have the horse standing to attention. And we walk round evening stables, and you've never seen horses so beautifully looked after, and you could have eaten your meal out of their mangers, you know. And when we'd looked round evening stables with this military precision, we came back into the house, and I'd got nowhere to live, nowhere to stay. But he asked me into the house. I thought, how nice, he's probably going to give me a drink and ask me whether I've got somewhere to stay. Not a bit of it. He handed me an entry form. And he said, now then, boy, have you ever done entries? And I said, well, just a little bit when I was with Mr. Cundall. Well, he said, here's last week's entry form. And this is the extract I make from it. And you'll soon work out my hieroglyphics. It's 20-odd meetings over the next week, 8 races each. You'll work out my hieroglyphics and do me a list in pencil on this paper. And then here's next week's entry form, and you can do that, and it'll look jolly good. Put it on my desk at 4:30 in the morning. So I went down the town and to the local hostelry, and I said, I don't want any food, I don't want anything, just give me a bed and I'll get this work done. And so I started at about 7 o'clock in the evening, and about 11:30 I'd got it all ruled off and it looked pretty well. And that was last week's entries. And now I could embark on next week's, and that took me till about 2 in the morning. And at 4:30, I put them on his desk. We went out to exercise at 6, and he was completely charming. And when we came back into the office after exercise, he said, "This is my desk. This is the secretary's desk, and that's your desk. They're the same now. I'm sitting at one of them." And on my desk, which was beautifully polished and absolutely nothing on it, was a pile of paper. And it had blue and red Barrow. And to make the list look better, I'd added blue and red Barrow. I thought how pleased he'd be. This pile of shredded paper. So I said to him, "Excuse me, sir, was there something you didn't like about the entries?" He said, "Boy," I said, "do them in pencil. Put them on my desk tomorrow morning at 4:30 and we'll get on fine." So that was day one.
And that formulated the relationship, didn't it?
It certainly did. It certainly did. And the relationship was founded on "you do just as I say and we'll get on fine. And when you have a bright idea, ask me." Yeah.
And he was kind of ahead of the times, though, in a way, because he was very analytical. In reading history.
Yes, yes. And he was a very good, funnily enough, I was with three trainers before I started. The one in the West Country was called Sid Koenig, who still is the best horseman I have ever encountered. He was, you know, the Monty Roberts of his time, but without doing it perhaps more naturally than Monty, without thinking it through, but he just naturally was a great, great horseman and could break in horses which people had failed to break in. He had a very interesting business model whereby he only had 12 boxes, 6 race horses, and 6 horses who had been, he would only have them if people had tried to break them and failed. So we had 6 maniacs, really, and 6 race horses. And I saw everything with him. And I'm eternally grateful that he was a great horseman. And then I was with Frank Cundall, who was a great placer of horses, a very tough man. I never formed any sort of really cordial relationship with him, but he was a marvellous, marvellous placer of horses. And he had a horse called Crudwell when I was with him. And Crudwell won 50 races. He won 50 races.
Wow.
Just extraordinary, on the flat, over hurdles, over fences. And when he was 15, he won his 50th race, and he was not very good, but Mr. Cundall managed to bluff everybody into into withdrawing, and he won his 50th race. And then I was with Mr. Waugh, who was very, very tough, taught you how to behave, taught you how methodically horses should be trained. And so I was very lucky in that, looking back on them now, 50 years gone by, I still think they were great men. And I think that's unusual.
One of the things that I've noticed in your career is, yes, you've done a marvelous job with classic horses, but there were horses that you were able to get 5, 6, 7 wins in the period of 2 weeks. And that comes back from the beginning, I would think.
Yes, I think that's a bit of Mr. Koenig and a bit of Mr. Cundall. But our great one was Masafi, who won 7 races in 17 days at 7 different courses.
Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Well, he was marvellous. He was marvellous. And he just kept improving. He was well handicapped. In England, a lot of races are handicaps. And in those days, there was a system whereby you could run off your old handicap mark for 11 to 13 days, and then during that period, you had a £6 penalty, and then you were reassessed again. And it just occurred to me that this horse could maybe take advantage of that system. He ran 7 times in 17 days and won them all. And he travelled the length and breadth of Britain. It was a long-term plan to see if you could do it. So he went into that period of racing being just marginally less fit than you would like, and you had to hope that you could win the first one and then maybe just keep improving enough to beat the handicapper. And he managed to do it. And we used to jog him up every morning. If you're a horseman, which you are, you'll know exactly what I mean. And he'd have won the day before and got back late in the evening. In the morning, we'd jog him up and see if he was sound. And he'd shake his head. You think, right, you know, you can go off again today or tomorrow or wherever it was. But after the seventh win, he didn't shake his head.
And you knew it was time to stop.
I knew it was time to stop. Yeah. And he went on and did well over hurdles. We sold him, and he went on. It in no way compromised his career. But he was a wonderfully tough horse. And I suppose I always think that training is like being a schoolmaster, and you've got to try and think what your pupils can do well and exploit what they can do. And what he could do was run frequently, and he was sound and generous, and he always ate up. And so he wasn't the greatest horse, but you could exploit him. And I think we did with him. There's lots of horses you feel you maybe haven't done as well as you should do, but I think with him we did as best as we could.
And some horses thrive on that type of work.
They do, and he did.
And I don't want to seem personal, but you're a well-known bachelor, and you gave the reason for bachelorhood on an interview that I saw because it gives you the time to think.
I think that's the great advantage of being a bachelor, that you do have more time to think, because you don't get back to the house with a catalogue of woes about the shopping and whether little Johnny's got to be picked up from school. And when I get back to the house, you've had a battering day at the races where it's gone wrong, or you've had a good day when it's gone right, and the place is quiet and you can do a bit of scheming. And I think it does allow you time to think, and I'm sure there's lots of disadvantages, but it allows you more time to think. Everybody, I think, would agree on that.
I know, and certainly my career pales in comparison to yours, but when I did well, when I had a 20% strike rate, it was when I was just married. But I had this exercise bike, and I would, after I'd come back, because I'm old school, so we always did evening stables, and I'd come back home, and we'd have a bit of dinner, and I'd go into my library and sit on the exercise bike for about 2 hours with the door shut and the lights off, and I never did so well as then.
Yeah.
So I can relate to your thought process there.
I think there's a great advantage, but everything is two sides, you see. And then you can think of, I'm sure you can in America, but I can think of them in England, very, very successful husband and wife combinations. And I think that my first trainer I worked for, Mr. War, who we were talking about, the very tough one, I had a girlfriend coming, and she came round evening stables, and he was absolutely charming. He loved having her. She was very pretty and knew a bit about racing and things, and he gave us a drink and so on. And then when she was walking off down the path, he turned to me and he said, "Now then, boy, what you've got to remember about wives is a good one is a £7 allowance, a bad one is a £21 penalty. There's 2 stone between them."
And it's very true.
And so that's a big risk, isn't it? It's a big risk.
It is. It is. And sometimes you don't get a chance to see them gallop that often.
No. But, you know, that we can think of those wonderful combinations where it really does work. And she is a 20, £28 probably in front of a bad one, you know.
But you're... Your dedication to Newmarket, that again has to do with the freedom to create and think. Because you've done things at Newmarket that people hadn't imagined doing.
Yes, I think Newmarket is it's a very competitive place, because nowadays you've got 81 trainers. So it's a very competitive place, but it's a professional place, and I love professionalism, and you can't think your horses don't look well if they don't here, because you see Mr. So-and-so's walking by, and if you need a gallop, if you get on with all your colleagues, as it teaches you to rub along with everybody, you know, you can borrow a gallop here or you can get a hand there. And so I think Newmarket's a marvellous place and a wonderful history, and I'm so lucky to have been here, and if I've done a bit of good for it, I'm very, very pleased. But I can see why people don't like it. But for training horses, they're the best public gallops in the world. I think there's no doubt about that. They're probably not the best private gallops. There might be better ones, less used. One thinks of Henry Candy's gallops, which have been down for since the 1720s. But they're the best public gallops in the world, and it's been a privilege to train on them and to do a bit to keep them as well as we possibly can. It's been a fascinating thing, and I've really enjoyed it. And of course, the horses in Newmarket have completely formulated how the town exists. So because of the gallops, the wonderful gallops here, not an acre was ploughed up in the war for the war effort. The motorway went 4 miles round it. The railway went 1.5 miles under it. So this strange bit of 2,500 acres of heathland, which has been managed in the same way since 1720 to our knowledge, this strange bit of land has completely formulated the area and the people and the horses who are here.
As time has gone on and racetracks are watering more and footing is a little bit different, how has Newmarket adjusted to that?
I think very well, because we built the all-weather gallops, which enabled us to take the increase in numbers. And strangely, I would think that the grass gallops now are better than they were when I first came here 50-odd years ago. Because it means that you can shut the grass gallops when the ground is either too soft or too hard or whatever. And so as a result, we've been able to protect the grass better than ever before. And I think the grass is better than when I first came here.
And horses have adapted to that as well.
Yes. I mean, the horses, the big change in Britain, which was probably unnoticed at the time and maybe not noticed so well now, is about 25 years ago, the jockey club who were running racing changed the watering rules. So the rule for watering turf in Britain up till then was that grass could only be watered to promote a healthy growth of grass and not to change the going. And about 25, 30 years ago, there was a big drought. The size of fields capsized. Big races were being run with farcically few runners. And under pressure from the press, I think, particularly, and also from trainers, the clerks of the courses were allowed to water to produce a safe racing surface. Now, that was a huge change. And it meant that we trainers could pressurize the clerks of the courses into watering more. And bit by bit, it changed the grass sward at most of our courses, and in the long term, probably not for the better. So the advent of all-weather racing and increased watering quite quickly changed the thoroughbred, so that it adapts very quickly, because the successful horses go to stud pretty quickly. And the longer past and longer foot suddenly became quite effective. And the modern horse is quite different now to what it was 50 years ago, where soundness was absolutely imperative. I mean, when I started training, of the 54 racecourses in Britain, only 17 had a watering system. So a horse most horses had to go on very firm turf, and that has gradually changed. Now, whether it's for the good or the better, I don't know, but the thoroughbred adapted very quickly.
I know there's a story about you having to come up with some statistics about that very early on.
Yes, when I first was with Mr. Warren, and he said, "What's the?" He gave me a task. He said, "Now then, boy," he said, "you haven't got much on tonight. Just look up and tell me what number of meetings last year were run on ground that was good to firm or firmer." So that was a nice little job, wasn't it? Looking up a year's worth of records. So I popped
and
in
no
the
computers.
Next. Sorry?
And no computers.
No, just counted them up. And I can't remember now whether it was 65 or 72% of races were run on good to firm or firmer ground. So Mr. Orr said to me, "Well done, boy," he said. "So what do you construe from that?" So we were going around the yearling sale. So I said, "The most important question to ask yourself is, would the horse go on firm ground?" He said, "Exactly." So at that time, the major question every trainer asked themselves at the yearling sale was, will this horse go on firm ground? So they tended to be lighter framed, little bit straighter past and little bit boxier feet, probably a little bit longer necked. And those horses were the ones who would go on firm ground. And then with the change in surfaces, of course, that quickly changed.
Now, in today's environment where stallions are covering 120, 130 mares, and you go to the sales, do you get to see the variety that you would like to see based on the changed footing in Europe?
No, I think nearly all of the trainers would agree that that diversity was a better thing. And certainly, you know, there are less horses each year in the sales that are bred to truly stay. And there are much more larger numbers, which are sprint or speed bred horses, which the Jockey Club or the BHA are trying to change in Britain now by instituting races designed to bring on the stayers. And it's always very strange, isn't it, the dichotomies in life, in that, you know, if you asked an owner what he would like to win, a new owner, he'd say the Derby, a mile and a half. And what other race would you like to win? And he'd say the Ascot Gold Cup, 2 miles and a half. And you say to him, "And what yearling would you like me to buy for your first horse?" And he said, "Oh, I like some nice fast one that sprints." Strange, isn't it?
It is, but it also, and that's a great point. It shows the difference in ownership at the beginning of our careers and now. Because, yes, we have owners that want to win those very, very prestigious races, but they want the instant gratification of that 2-year-old or early 3-year-old that can go 3/4 of a mile.
Yeah.
And that makes it very, very difficult, I think, as a bloodstock agent to really fill the orders of the owners and make them comfortable.
Yes, I think it does. It's this strange thing, and there's another sort of strange thing. I always think that now I've been training for a longish time. We all know that young trainers tend to hurry their horses perhaps a bit more than they should, and yet the young trainer has got all the time in the world. And we all know that the old trainers tend to give them too much time, and they've got no time at all.
One of the continual ironies of the horse industry.
Yeah. It's just fascinating, isn't it?
It is. But if we look at people, we had no patience when we were in our 20s.
None.
And we have slightly more now.
Much. It's the only thing I've enjoyed about getting older. I don't know about you. The only thing I've enjoyed is I don't get so cross anymore.
That's exactly it. But you run, from what I understand, you run a pretty tight ship.
Yes, I hope so. It would be more. It would be tighter, perhaps, than the most of the modern yards. I don't know whether that's better or not, but it gives me satisfaction. And you know, we try and keep the standards up. But who knows whether that actually means you win more races? I don't know.
Well, from an outsider looking in, and we'll put the strike rate aside, we'll look at the personnel. Just out of curiosity, how many jockeys have you ridden regularly in your career?
I've only had three jockeys in 53 years.
So that seems to work pretty well. And you have an assistant, Mr. Butler. How long's he been with you?
Oh, 23 or 4. And my head man, Colin's been here 52, I think.
Yeah, and that's my point. It may be a tough ship, but it's a just ship. And that's, again, I'm sounding like an old guy, which I am, but that's the difference in creating a barn culture than a place for people to come to work.
Yeah,
I commend you for that.
You hope so. But we've had a lot of successful trainers have spent their time with us, which has been very, very rewarding and great fun. And I think, you know, as good as training Pivotal and Alpinista and all those sort of things, they're great days. The other great days is seeing people do really, really well who were with you as pupils and assistants. And I've got three or four in France. And when that filly won the other day, I think almost the best was all of them congratulating you. And, you know, we've had Pascal Barry and Christophe Ferland and Francois Roja. And, you know, as well as being kissed by Mr. Jean-Claude Rouget, it made for an extraordinarily satisfying day. And to see them do so well, Owen and Neil sadly wasn't there, but so all my sort of French trainers were there, and it added to it tremendously. And of course they love to beat me as well, but they forget that if I've got to be beaten, I'd rather be beaten by them.
What did the Sunday after the Arc feel like to you when everybody was gone and you were sitting down in the evening?
Well, it was marvelous, but sadly it was the sales were on here, which is our busiest week.
Right.
So you'd missed a day by being in France when you normally would have been looking around. So there was this huge backlog of horses that you hadn't seen at the sales. And then it was compounded by all the kind people who sent messages and faxes and emails and letters. And I'm looking as I speak to you at a pile of unanswered letters from people, which sort of, it meant that you couldn't wallow in it as much as you'd like. You got an awful lot on, but it didn't stop me having a wonderful day. And when I went around the sales the next day, I mean, it was marvelous how kind people were.
That's part of the beauty of our business, because there never is really downtime.
No.
And there's always a reason to look forward to waking up in the morning.
And there's always that dread in the morning about something you were worried about last night, don't you agree?
This is true also. The worst thing that I've ever done is I've installed cameras in all my stalls here at the farm.
Right.
And not to sound crass, but in the middle of the night, I sometimes have to wake up.
Yes.
And I find myself up for an hour looking in all the boxes to make sure everybody's okay.
Yes,
because the dread is always there.
You now have the ability to do it, and therefore, if you're a perfectionist, it becomes your tyrant.
It's also to me when I walk out and I see them in the morning and they're hollering for their breakfast and they've all eaten up the night before and everything else. That to me is worth it.
It is. It is. You know, but it's a rare day where everything's all right, isn't it? And You know, well, you there's always one that hasn't eaten up, or this is lame, or, and if you're not careful, you can make that spoil your day. But that's why training is not for everybody, isn't it? Because if you focus on the things that are going wrong, there's an awful lot of them. And Paul Cole, who's a very famous trainer over here and trained marvellous horses like Generous and Snurge and so on, he said one of the great things about training, which I'm sure you will enjoy, he said that the best thing about training is you can't worry about any disaster for too long, because a catastrophe is just taking place.
That's great. But you have a very good line about young horses, something to the effect of they're still dreams.
Yeah. Well, the other, that wasn't me, I'm ashamed to say. We had a very good Epsom trainer called Philip Mitchell, and he said that the yearling sale is where the dream begins. The horses in training sale is where the nightmare ends.
And unfortunately, that's so true many times.
Both of them, both Paul Cole and Philip Mitchell. I wish I'd said those things. I think they encapsulate training, you know.
Could we take a second to talk about Mr. Butler?
Yep.
Because he's been with you for, 20 years?
20-something years.
And he has a broad base of knowledge. And that must be a relief to have somebody behind you like that.
It makes all the difference, doesn't it? And, I mean, for Paul William, of course, he would like to take over, and he's well ready to take over, and everybody knows he can do the job and would do it very well. So there's an element, obviously, of him that would feel impatient. And, of course, because he's such a help, it means I can totter on longer. So it's sort of it's almost self-defeating for William. But on the other hand, the period of time I had with Mr. War was the best time of my life, I think, because Mr. War allowed me to know everything. In the end, he trusted me completely. You did have that wonderful thing that if William goes away on holiday, you know, for 2 weeks, the phone doesn't ring. It's not his worry. But he's got all the interest and all the excitement and puts in tremendous hours and effort. But the good side is that, you know, one day it'll be his anyway. And in the short term, at least when he goes away and he doesn't have to worry. So I think there's pluses for him, but the minuses are obvious. And everybody always says to me, how's poor William?
Now, the rest of your staff has been, actually, didn't they get an award last week for the job that they did at the Ark?
They did, and thanks to Annabelle, who looks after Alpinista, the world pool moment of the year was Alpinista winning and the girls being tearful and meeting her and all the rest, and so thanks to Annabelle, everybody got a huge payout. So we've had a very lucky autumn, you know. For a small stable, we only have 50 horses. It was 50 boxes. It's been a marvelous autumn, and we've been very lucky. We must enjoy it.
You know, people now, there's guys with 250, 300 horses. I barely can take care of 24. You've kept it at 50. Is that a comfortable number for you?
For me, it is. But it's a very personal thing, isn't it? You know, some people can run an international company. Some people can run a department store. Someone else can run a corner shop. You've got to know what you can deal with and your method. Will your method deal with that? And I go around stables every night if I can, feel all the legs, turn them over, jog them up if necessary. And when I've done my 50, do you know, I've never thought I'd like to do it 5 more times.
Exactly. But the reason I think that you're so successful with 50 is because you can do it with 50.
Yes, I can. That's my number. And I don't want more. And I never did want more. But the big concerns do it very well. They have systems in place, which unfortunately mean that they do it very well. And they've delegated and they've broken it down into parcels that work, and they're highly successful. I wouldn't like it because I like to do it myself, but I can quite see that it's a very successful business model and gives you a lot of satisfaction at the top. But I never wanted to be champion trainer. I wanted to be the best trainer, and that's not always the same.
I noticed in some of the videos that I've watched, you have skins and paintings all throughout. And as you were just talking now, training is art for you, isn't it?
Training is what?
Art.
Yeah.
You're an artist.
Yes, I love it.
And so 50, and you're creating and you're bringing them up and you're seeing the generations develop. And you're seeing the babies of the mares that you've trained. That's art. That's living art, in my opinion.
There's an element of art in it, isn't there? And there's a big element of school being the school teacher. I mean, you've done it yourself. You might not agree with me, but I think that a lot of it is that the horse is the child, the race course is the exam, the owner is the parent, and you're the teacher. And if your school does it better than most, 90% of the children will be suited by your school. If your school's not quite as good, then probably 20% of them won't be suited by it, and so on. But I think the good trainers, their system suits more pupils than the others. And an element of art comes into that. I think children is the analogy. Would you agree or not?
Oh, absolutely. I've always felt that we're dealing with the equivalent of preschool children, and we're going to try and get them to graduate.
Yeah.
And we've taken the word breaking out of our stable. We don't use that language any longer. We're educating the horse.
It's a bad word, breaking, isn't it?
Converse to what we're trying to do.
Yeah. It's absolutely the wrong word. And yet, obviously, I mean, I'm afraid I still do it. But I think you're right. Educating should be the word. But I still say, you send your filly in and we'll break her in. I shouldn't. You should say educate.
That's habit more than
it is.
A cognitive thing.
But it's something something I really learned today. I think that is a very good substitute.
Well, thank you. If I ever thought I could teach you something, that's beyond my pale.
Well, you've done it.
Okay, good. Now, the other thing I want to talk about.
Because before you leave the subject, I think educating or breaking is the single most important thing that happens to any horse. And I think that if they're well broken, they adjusted to the life, they become willing, happy, compliant, confident animals. And if they're no good, and let's face it, most horses are pretty slow, if they're no good, they will gravitate to a good home. But if they've got no mouth, no manners, no anything, their fate is parlous. So as horsemen, what we can do for them is educate them properly, and then that horse has a better chance for the rest of his life.
Exactly.
Significantly better than any other horse. Would you agree?
100%. So we'll take horses off the track at here at the farm every so often, and that's exactly our philosophy. Matter of fact, we don't touch them with tack for 2 months when they come off the track.
Right.
We just let them throw their head down in the grass and be horses, and then we start the process, because it is education. And we use them till they're 5 or 6 years old.
Yeah.
But they're going to live till 30.
Yeah.
So we've got to give them a life.
You have. And the best chance is like your child. If your child is absolutely brilliant and is top of the class and everything, he can be pretty rude. He can slop around. He can look like nothing on earth. But if you're, and he'll get by because talent will get him by. But if he's an ordinary child and not over bright and not particularly, he needs to be sharp, polite, and then he'll get on. So what you can do for your child or do for your horse is to make them nice people. And then they, if their career as a racehorse is limited, they'll gravitate to a good home and you've done your best for him. I think educating them, which is the new word I'm going to use, educating them is the best thing you can do for any horse.
Well, I agree with you. Also, and you do this at Heath House, feed is so important, and you get them to relax so they can enjoy their feed.
Yeah, they got to relax, haven't they?
They do. And you have Crazy Corner. Can you just very quickly let us know about Crazy Corner? And then I have one other question, and I'm going to let you go.
For American listeners and things, we've got two stable yards, both built, one built in the 1850s and the other built way back. In fact, some of the boxes, 11 of them, are on the 1604 map. 1604, they've had racehorses in. And the disadvantages are obvious with those very old stables. They need a lot of repair and one thing or another. But the advantages are considerable because they're pokey little boxes and some of the horses can look out into the yard and some they can't. And you can more or less satisfy the needs of all those fillies who perhaps walk the box or stand at the door yapping at people walking by and so on. You ought to be able to find a box that suits them. And I always think our funny little yard over there has trained me an awful lot of winners by managing to cater for those horses who have different requirements. And Crazy Corner is two stables where the horses can see one another, but they can't see out into the yard. So they've got each other for companionship. And when there's other horses going out around the stables and they might be worrying, they can't see them and they're happy with that. And they've got a mirror as well in each of the boxes. I'm not sure that works, but it helps. And certainly Crazy Corner has trained us a lot of winners. And one of the boxes, one of the stables, also has a compartment where you can put in a companion goat or a companion sheep. We use a goat. And they have trained a lot of winners. It does show that if you can just fiddly away around their minds, it can be very successful. But we call it Crazy Corner.
So I have this vision that at the end of the day, you sit down and you just contemplate what's going on in your horse's minds. And the things that are going wrong, you start looking at them almost as though you were the horse.
Yeah, try to.
And that's the key, isn't it?
It is. I think some horsemen do it because they're natural horsemen and they can't even tell you why. Mr. Koenig, who I started with, he couldn't really tell you why he did things, but you had to keep your eyes open and watch. Or they're very, they learn and they quickly adapt to it. But I think those natural horsemen, they always have the edge and they instinctively know, don't they, what it's going to do, and they can't really tell you. I think one of the interesting things about learning and teaching is that if you see those great tennis players, they're often coached by someone much less good than they were, and they're always looking up into the crowd to see what the coach is saying. And those great jockeys, you could say to Pat Eddery, "Pat, why did you drop this horse out? Why did you do whatever?" And he'd shrug his shoulders and say, "I haven't a clue." I can hear him saying it. "I haven't a clue." And he hadn't a clue because he just did it naturally. But Pat perhaps wouldn't have been a great teacher, whereas a jockey who got to the top by thinking about it, he can impart more knowledge to you. The natural horseman and the natural jockey, they find it difficult to tell you why. They just do it.
That instinct.
Yeah, they just do it.
I want to let you go. We've taken longer than I anticipated you being on the phone, and I so appreciate it.
Well, I've thoroughly enjoyed being. It's a privilege to be interviewed, and if any of it's of any interest, I'm delighted.
Now, I have to ask you, though, the most important question. Okay, this is the parting question. Who selects your ties?
Me.
For those of you that don't know Sir Mark, the man has the best ties, not only in the industry, but probably amongst all the haberdashers in England.
Well, what I'm lucky because now ties have fallen out of fashion so tremendously. I was thinking about it the other day. Will you be able to buy ties like you used to be able to? But whenever I saw a nice tie, I have to admit, I was always tempted to buy it.
Well, I will tell you this. I haven't worn a tie to the paddock in years, but I've got a tie now. Next time we start one, I'll be wearing it. You've influenced me.
Well, in return for change, dropping that word breaking in, it will have been fair exchange. Yeah.
Good deal. Sir Mark, it was, again, a pleasure and a privilege, and I wish you the best of luck, and hopefully we get to chat soon again.
I look forward to it, and if any of you are over in England and you want to have a snoop round Newmarket, give me a ring. It would be a pleasure to show you around.
That would be wonderful. And we'll send the link of the show to Diane.
Lovely, lovely. Thank you very much indeed, both of you.
Thank you.
Bye.
And that's this episode of the Thoroughbred Post. We'll be with you again next Monday. Look forward to chatting.